federal monies, then you could not discriminate based on race, gender, religion.
Bebu is a proud co-sponsor of the Portland Folk Music Society 2018-19 concert season. Guy Davis is the featured performer at the March 15th concert at the Reedwood Friends Church in Portland. Guy Davis is an American blues guitarist, banjo, and harmonica player. The singer-songwriter has stated, "Folk music was the doorway I came into the blues from, and I want people hearing the song to know life is precious and the road is not always an easy place to be." Mary Flower will open the show, bringing her finger-picking and slide guitar-style blues to the PFS stage. That's Guy Davis and Mary Flower performing on Friday, March 15th at 7:30 p.m. at the Reedwood Friends Church, 2901 Southeast Steele Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. Keep you cool until my daddy come. Ain't no ice man
under ice. KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Clinton Street Resistance Series every Monday night at the Clinton Street Theater. Monday, March 4th, Clinton Street Resistance will screen The Great Muppet Caper, where Kermit the Frog, The Great Gonzo, and Fozzie Bear are reporters for the Daily Chronicle, traveling to Britain to report on the theft of the baseball diamond. This week's screening benefits the Circus Project. Again, that's The Great Muppet Caper, showing Monday, March 4th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
And you're listening to KBOO Portland. Up next is a special presentation of author Rima Zeman's recent reading at Powell's Books of her latest memoir, I Am Yours. This is KBOO Portland Community Radio for all of Portland and beyond, online found at kboo.fm.
I'm Emily Gresham Beamer with KBOO News. On Sunday, author Rima Zeman spoke at Powell's Books, sharing stories from her new memoir, I Am Yours. She was joined in conversation with Lydia Yuknovich, author of the New York Times bestseller, Book of Joan. Zeman's memoir has become a Powell's bestseller, and her work has been featured in publications such as The Guardian, Salon, and The New York Times, to name a few. Rima is an Oregon Literary Arts Writer of Color Fellow.
Tonight, we are excited to welcome Rima Zeman. Rima is an award-winning writer, speaker, actress, and author of the critically acclaimed memoir, I Am Yours, which debuted on the Powell's bestsellers list alongside Michelle Obama's memoir, Becoming. Born in Bangladesh and raised in Thailand, Rima's work has appeared in The New York Times, Miss Magazine, Vogue, The Guardian, Salon, Guernica, Longreach, Shape, and elsewhere. Rima has the honor of partnering with the International Rescue Committee and Girls Inc. to serve crucial causes and empower the next generation of leaders. Rima is the 2018 Oregon Literary Arts Writer of Color Fellow and holds a double BA in Gender Studies and Theater from Skidmore College. As the only Rima Zeman in the world, she is easy to find on social media. You can follow her on Instagram and Twitter and learn more at rimazeman.com. Rima is here to discuss her debut memoir, I Am Yours. I Am Yours has been called a moving story about how one woman found her voice and her power by Cheryl Strayed. Gemma Hartley, author of Fed Up, Emotional Labor, Women, and the Way Forward, called it one of those rare books that begs to be devoured and savored in equal measure. It's more than a memoir, it's a spiritual guide. I am pleased to note that Rima's memoir has been adapted into the curriculum for several high schools through an innovation grant from the Oregon Department of Education. Yeah, it was like, great achievement. Although I've only known Rima for a year, every one of these remarks rang true. Rima is a force to be reckoned with. I first met her through a Facebook group where she posted a link to a piece that had been recently published. I found the piece to be remarkable, and I told her so, not assuming that someone as cool as Rima would respond. but she did. And we continued to chat and share our stories with each other. And now here we are. I am so honored to introduce Rima at the greatest bookstore in the world, and I'm so happy that she exists and that we all get to experience her as she is. She has joined a conversation with Lydia Yuknovich, who by now needs no introduction, but I'm gonna give her one anyway. Lydia is the national bestseller author of The Bad Small Backs of Children and The Book of Joan, winner of the 2016 Oregon Book Awards Ken Kesey Award for Fiction, as well as the Reader's Choice Award. Her wildly acclaimed memoir, The Chronology of Water, was a finalist for a Penn Center USA Award for Creative Nonfiction and a winner of the PNBA Award and the Oregon Book Awards Reader's Choice. The Misfits Manifesto, a book based on her recent TED Talk, was published by TED Books. Her new collection of fiction, Verge, is due out from Riverhead Books in winter 2020. She founded the workshop series Corporeal Writers and Writing in Portland, Oregon, where she teaches both in person and online. Tonight's event will also include a Q&A if you have any questions for Rima or Lydia. The books on those cart over there have already been pre-signed, but if you would like a copy personalized or just want a fangirl over Rima to her face, you can light up on the west side of the room when you do so, when that time comes. You can then pay for them downstairs in the orange or green room on the first floor after they've been signed. And then we're gonna start with Lydia, so now please welcome Lydia.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Is it working? The boob mic. I just want to do some gushing about Rima really fast. It's not her bio. It's just from my chest or something. I first met Rima inside language, which is to say we were writers and readers, bodies swimming around inside word worlds before we even spoke to one another. The second time I met Rima, we actually did speak to each other here in normal human word things to each other. And we were both therefore immediately awkward and lovely and authentically bumbly. So if I remember right, we might have used less words and more our faces and hands and eyes and hugging and bumping and weirdness. But it was very real. Rima's writing stakes a claim for love as a radical act. Like Audre Lorde staking a claim for occupying erotics as a fierce force field. Like bell hooks insistent on love as a choice to abandon the stories we've been told in favor of changing the paradigm of the world. This voice is hard won. This voice emerges from every layer of everything the world has done to keep a woman of color silent and obedient to a system that would soul murder her. This is a voice rising up from dirt and mud and sweat. Rima's voice represents an amplified moment inside a crushing global system of oppression, which such clarity and beauty, you find yourself holding your breath while you're reading it. And I think we should be holding our breath more often as the new voices emerge. I'm beginning to be old, so I'm going to say a generational thing. But don't panic, it's not maternal. I'm in the over 50 bracket, and so I noticed a thing that happens to aging writers where we get like cranky and shitty. We're like, you know, get off my lawn. I had to walk 9 miles in the snow to get this book out. Who are you, young upstart? Like this weird, bitter, creepy, also exhaustion, you know. And I want to say, could we please, please not be that ever again? Because the newest generations of writers, and I met some today at Corporeal, but mostly tonight celebrating Rima, the newest generation of writers, remind us of something so profoundly important, which is this. The storytelling happened before any of us were born. And the storytelling's gonna go on after all of us die. And every new writer keeps the pulse alive for us all. So could you please help me welcome the pulse of writing, Rima.
Thank you for coming out tonight. My name is Rima Zaman, and I'm the author of the memoir, I Am Yours. And I thought I would begin the evening with a love letter and a warrior cry. And this is a story from I Am Yours, and it is about the man who I thought was the love of my life. When my husband proposed to me, he announced that he would not be buying a diamond ring because he didn't want to participate in blood diamonds. I remember biting back my tongue that not all diamonds have to be blood diamonds, but I didn't say anything because I knew that were I to speak, he would only use my words against me as proof of my selfishness, proof of my ingratitude, proof of my misbehavior. I knew better than to speak. We were married in the dead of winter on January 4, 2010. And once we got married, we moved onto his sailboat, which was parked on the ice with a gorgeous view of the Statue of Liberty. Now, this was a sailboat, not a houseboat. It was tiny, and it was 29 feet in length, and we didn't have any indoor heating or plumbing. And to stay warm, my husband lined the entire inside of the boat with space heaters and electric blankets. I'm pretty sure we were a fire hazard. To cook our meals, we had a hot plate and a pressure cooker, and life was sweet and simple. And we were in love. It's all we needed. He had recently purchased a half-burnt barn tucked in deep upstate Connecticut, and a fire in the 1980s had eaten up half of the barn. My husband had bought this using a hefty gift from his mother as well as a bank loan. He had this gorgeous vision of rebuilding the barn into a habitable home for us and our future kids. So every day he would drive the 2 hours upstate to work on the barn, while I would walk the 2 miles through the snow to get to the subway station to go into Manhattan to my babysitting job. In the evenings, we would meet back at the boat. He would work on architectural plans, while I would work on a song or an essay or a drawing. I had started selling my art for much needed cash. I use pen and pencil for my drawings, and I love that pencil comes from graphite, and graphite is a form of carbon. And carbon, when exposed to extreme heat and enormous pressure, will become diamond. Oh, I loved thinking of this as I would sit in that freezing boat, pressing down on a page using a piece of charcoal or a pencil. Carbon, when exposed to extreme heat and enormous pressure, will become diamond. Graphite, under pressure, will become art. Art is, after all, the act of taking pain and turning it into poetry. Winter turned into spring, and my husband and I moved out of our boat and into his VW bus, parked in front of the barn. The spring turned into summer, and these warmer months were really good for us. He would work all day long on the barn, while I would sit beside it on a field, working on a drawing or a piece of music or an essay. I started running long miles in the woods surrounding the barn. And these long days with hard work, they were really good for my husband's moods. He became a better man anytime he felt like he had a clear purpose in life. And it was when that purpose slipped away, or he let it slip away, that his shadows would take over. Summer shifted into fall, and lo and behold, we ran out of money. My husband had developed a habit of taking a part of every month's loan, which was meant for construction materials and hired labor. He would invest that instead into drinking and on going out to lavish restaurants by himself while I was at my nannying job. He enjoyed going by himself because then this would free him up to speak to whomever he found there, namely other women. So he would spend $100 here, $100 there, flirting and drinking and chatting with other women, while I would take care of other people's children, working so hard to make pennies to support our life together. The more things he let slip away, the further he slipped into shadow. The further he slipped into shadow, the further I drew away from him and into my art. I started taking all the love that I had tried to give him and that he would reject, I poured them into the page. All the words that I had tried to speak but were silenced, I poured them into the page. And lo and behold, my art began to improve. My drawings became more complex, more dark, more mature, until I began selling them for larger and larger amounts. Beginning initially at $100, moving all the way up to $1,000, $3,000, $5,000, and with every sale, my husband grew both happy and resentful. My growing talent both impressed and insulted him. It was as if he thought there was space for only one voice in our relationship, and that voice had to be his. It was as if he believed that my growing spirit threatened his. The more threatened he became, the tighter he squeezed. To trap, to choke. He started calling me wife for greensies, not for realsies. To remind me that my green card had been procured through marriage. Wife for greensies, not for realsies, to remind me that my ability to live and work in the United States was dependent and tied to him. Wife for greensies, not for realsies, to remind me that I was beholden to him, and were I to speak out, I could be rejected and even deported. Wife for greensies, not for realsies, to remind me that power only responds to power. And in his eyes, I, as his Bangladeshi immigrant wife, to his white male superior privilege, he believed I was powerless. Moreover, his appetite for other women had grown stronger. He started coming home with fistfuls of receipts with their names and numbers scrawled on him, collected from the bartending job he had to support our bills. He would bring home these receipts like medals from a successful day. But the thing is, in the story of my husband and I, my voice was the plot twist. The more cruel he became, the more insistently my inner voice began to speak, as if to warn me, protect me, comfort me, until soon I was waking up with fully constructed essays delivered onto the doorstep of my brain. And my sole daily task was to take dictation from the wisdom of my inner voice. These essays sent to me from the mysterious ether were meticulously crafted debates and exposés on love, relationships, on my marriage, on my parents' marriage, on my childhood, and the sexual assaults I had experienced as a teenager, as a young woman. And these essays started to teach me that unhealed trauma, if left unchecked, it can metastasize into a perilous tolerance, attraction, and even loyalty to abusive forces. These essays were the coalescence and compression of all of my lived and learned experience. These essays, as I would type them and read them back, the words on the page would shimmer with the presence of thousands of unseen, invisible sisters, each one crying, "Me too, me too, me too, I am out there, you are not alone, and there is a way out." These essays, as I typed and read them back, they began to fill me with the clarity and validation I needed to realize that contrary to what he was saying, I was not a worthless human being after all. Contrary to what he was doing, I was not dependent and powerless after all. Contrary to what he believed, I was not a piece of forgettable mundane earth, but rather a jewel in the making. Carbon, when exposed to extreme heat and enormous pressure, will become diamond. The more cruel he became, the more I wrote. The more I wrote, the clearer I grew. I grew so clear that I began to refract light, much like a diamond will when held up against the almighty sun. I began to run longer and long miles through the woods surrounding the barn, 7 miles, 10 miles, 12, 15, and which every step, every mile, I would recite a story or a song that I had written. I love a mean, mean man. I gave him all I am. He holds my voice in his hands. I need an exit plan. You better run, baby. Run, run, baby. Better run, baby. Run, run, baby. Better run, baby. Run, run, baby. Better run. 'Cause he's coming for you. With every mile, every word, every story, every song, I could feel myself growing stronger. I could feel the act of body pressing upon ground was enhancing me. Carbon, when exposed to extreme heat and enormous pressure, will become diamond. I realized that should I need to, should I want to, I could run away from him and toward my freedom. Fall grew into winter, and soon here was Valentine's Day, 2011. My husband picked me up from the train station after a long day of bartending for him and babysitting for me. In the car from the train station over to the barn, he brandished that day's fistful of other women's names. I looked at him, his profile in the darkness, and I remember thinking, what happened to you? What made you into a person who wishes to inflict pain on others? We are all born as children, innocent, and then we become the love or the pain that is taught to us. And because of this, I said nothing. Because of this, I never yelled. We arrived at the barn. We walked through the snow and over the plank of wood that existed in place of steps, and we entered the structure. Inside, the air smelled like something was dying. Love, perhaps. In the far left corner of the barn was our trusty queen-size mattress. Surrounding the mattress were piles of bricks and space heaters. Strung here and there from the barn rafters were naked light bulbs. I had memorized how to walk around these light bulbs with my eyes closed because the burning glass promised to singe the skin if touched. That is what abuse is. It is like dancing upon broken glass. All around us, thanks to the fire, were big black patches of burned wood. The walls of our lives had been licked by darkness. It's as though I had circled myself with danger, thinking this is what I deserved. For Valentine's Day, I had baked two heart-shaped cakes, one for the boy I babysat and one for my husband. My husband took his cake, reclined on the bed, and began eating chunks, using his fingers, all the while regaling me with stories of the women he had flirted with that evening. You better run, baby, run, run, baby, better run, baby, run, run, baby, better run, baby, run, run, baby, better run. 'Cause he's coming for you. Suddenly, I felt the rush of the past merging with the present, of pain turning into poetry, of words compressing into power. No, the words sounded so foreign, so small, like a cold, hard little pebble perched on my tongue, begging to be spat out. What? He frowned. No, you are not the one who decides my identity. I author my life, and I was born for a story so much bigger than you. To speak is a revolution, and it was time to ignite mine. That first no is always the hardest, but the voice is a muscle, and the more we use it, the stronger it grows. That first time that I said no to my ex-husband, he laughed and then grew angry. But I kept saying, no, 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 until finally we parted. He evicted me from our home. By speaking, I had become a fire he could not control. Carbon, when exposed to extreme heat and enormous pressure, will become diamond. I am so glad that he never bought me a ring. I am, and I contain so much more than he could have ever given me. I'm grateful that he worked to destroy us. Had I remained in the confines of his embrace, I would have never discovered the full volume of my voice. I stand here in front of you as a conduit of a larger story, as a reminder and a mirror of the power within all women, of the power within anyone who has ever been told to be silent. I, like you, was born and designed for resilience, born and designed to turn pain into poetry, wound into wisdom, the past into the future. I wrote, "I am yours," as a testament to the fire and the light within all of us. I wrote, "I am yours," because every time I speak, another silenced voice hears that they matter, that they too, you too, me too, we too. We are all vital voices in a collective, connective roar. I wrote, "I am yours," to provide the words of love and solidarity I wish someone had known to give me when I was raped when I was 23, when I was a 15-year-old girl suffering from anorexia, when I was a young woman trapped in an abusive marriage, when I immigrated to the States by myself. I wrote, "I am yours," as a call to action and empathy for the men in our lives. For the world to heal and evolve, we, your daughters, partners, lovers, wives, sisters, your fellow human beings, your neighbors, we all need to join together. We need not only your loyalty, but your active participation. I wrote, "I am yours," to provide medicine. I wrote, "I am yours," because it is the first book that has ever been written and published by a Bangladeshi woman speaking out against abuse, assault, and mental health. I wrote, "I am yours," because the best thing about being the first is that it makes it possible for there to be a second, and a third, and a fourth, and a fifth, and a sixth, until we lose count, because there is no more need to keep count. I wrote, "I am yours," so that years from now, my daughters and granddaughters and great-granddaughters will not have to weep over the same wounds that made my mother and I cry. I wrote, "I am yours," because it is time. To speak is a revolution. These are our voices, and this is our rise. Thank you for being part of this.
I had you right here, too.
So, Rima, beautiful, beautiful reading. And thank you for letting me share some space with you to talk about the themes and the art and the pain and the beauty in your writing. Very thrilled to be here with you.
Thrilled to be here with you.
So I want to ask you something that comes from partly what you just read, and partly just having met you and talked to you and seen your writing. And I don't know the answer to this myself, but I've been thinking about it. Do you think that women, in general, have to invent or forge their own version of what we mean when we say strength?
Yes.
But there's a way in which, in my reading experience, there's a constant reinvention of strength, but not in the ways we're used to, not the definitions we're used to. There are these new forms of strength that emerge in every piece of the story. Mm. And so could you talk about your understanding of strength in a woman?
Yes, thank you. I think the world is suffering from a misunderstanding and celebration of a toxic kind of strength, which has actually been like the normalization of violence. And for so long, we were modeled that and encouraged to become kind of this aggro violent strength.
And that's actually why we're suffering so much as cultures, as societies, and as individuals and families. And so my understanding of strength, it has to be a new story. We have to author our own definition of an authentic kind of power, an authentic kind of strength. And for me, because I had fallen ill to the kind of toxic power and strength that the world celebrates, that for me had manifested as anorexia, because I felt, as many young girls feel, that in a world that only rewards violence and objectification and continually tells women that we are powerless, I latched onto toxic beauty culture as though it was the only strength that was allowed to me, as though it was only power and stronghold it was allowed, that I was allowed to have. And that, because any kind of toxic power, if we love it too enthusiastically, be it wealth, violence, status, fame, or beauty, that power will become our prison. And that's certainly how my first attachment to toxic strength, that's how it became an imprisonment for me. And so then I had to author a new story and go back to what feels like true strength, and that's kindness, integrity, compassion for oneself and one's fellow human being, empathy. I mean, the power and capability to forgive is it's one of the most strongest things possible, you know? Because it's the opposite of control, and toxic strength is governed by control, mm-hmm. right? So writing this book and going through my life page by page, it taught me all of that, a reinvention and adoption of a new authentic kind of strength. And so when I stand, you know, I'm a very vocal person on every medium and channel available in our contemporary culture. So I will take to every single social media channel, and I will encourage people to stand in their strength and their power, because I think after so many generations of telling women and encouraging women to be silent, timid, docile, and pleasing, when we stand in our authentic power as women, that is a radical act of healing and dissent against a culture that wants us to be quiet and timid.
Yeah. On that healing
yes.
topic, mm-hmm. so many times in your book I felt like magic spells were happening. It's the feeling I had alone in my underwear at my house. And then I, you know, pull up and like, wait, what is that?
Right.
And so I want to ask you a question about healing, but I want you to have heard me said I felt like magic was happening. And I guess I want to know, you know, where do you come down on the question of, is storytelling magic? Is storytelling medicine? Is there such a thing as narrative healing? And it kind of plugs into your ideas about turning pain into beauty, which came up.
Thank you.
Three times I was listening
yes.
in the piece you read.
Yeah.
But how do you talk about that? How do you experience it?
I feel that, especially as any marginalized person who has been continually told that they are unworthy of having a voice, the very act of putting our words, our voice into being, is healing in and of itself. Any kind of trauma, I believe it settles in the body as a three-pronged wound. And the first one being voicelessness.
Right.
The second one being the feeling of loneliness. We think we are absolutely alone in that grief or loss or abandonment or assault. Mm-hmm. And the third prong is feelings of insignificance. And so to heal truly and in a sustainable manner, the first thing we have to do is reclaim our voice, whether that's in the silence of our own private solitude in our brains, to be able to give voice to the things that were done to us, or to speak it out loud in a support group or within a trusted relationship. The reclamation of voice is so hugely healing, because voicelessness is part of the wound that has been inflicted. And then when we speak
and allow our voices to be heard and allow it to travel and connect with another human being, that connection creates community, and community is the natural healing balm for loneliness. Mm-hmm. It's the antidote. So that second prong is taken care of. And then by connecting and telling each other, yes, me too, you are not alone. I too have gone through this. This is what I've learned, and perhaps you can use it too. That's service. And service is the antidote to feelings of insignificance, because service is the most authentic presence and power we can have in each other's lives. And so I believe art is incredibly healing, and I feel it as a social responsibility. One of the things I'll read tonight is, it's the first few pages that I had written in I Am Yours. And when I wrote it, I not only realized that I had a story to tell, but I had a responsibility to tell this story, because it was so much bigger than me.
You know, it would be really good right this second.
Should I read that? The next night we have sex, I realize he has left. I feel it in his touch. Moreover, I can feel he has been with someone else. Wrapped in our vortex, I feel a cold stillness spread through me like a river lost, trying to find its way to an ocean it doesn't know. Perhaps women feel this more acutely for the way our bodies are shaped, to receive and form to a man's. As we feel your touch change from sweet to bitter, caring to cold, or worse, apathetic, we morph as well. We change from your cradle to your receptacle, your garden to your wasteland, an area bereft of value, meaning, or beauty. A land deemed ruined, barren of interest, where waste is deposited and things go to die. He has been with someone else, and rather recently. She exists vividly in the air. I don't smell her. I don't find traces of lipstick on a collar. She lives in his distance, hovering the way a foreshadow floats between two people. I move horizontally, back and forth, back and forth, sandwiched between him and the bed, kneaded like dough as he burrows into me. My head is turned to the left. His chin with its light stubble grinds into my forehead. In the morning, I'll have to hold an aspirin moistened with water against the raw spot. It will soothe the red. My eyes memorize the titles of books and boxes along the walls. I fill with boredom from being here again, tired of this story that folds back unto itself. I'm weary of being insipid to a man. I loathe myself for yet again choosing someone who makes me feel this way. I recover my clothes off the floor like Gretel, retrieving crumbs to find her way home. I layer my layers, an unwanted object covering itself. In my coat, at the door, I turn around. Are you happy? Sorrow keeps me from voicing the question our bodies have answered. Yes, he replies. I am happy. How am I here? The years are stacking. I am 11. Papa says boys will be boys. It happens. I am 18. The tag on my school uniform collar grates the back of my neck like a vegetable peeler strips an unpleasing outer layer. The principal interrogates me. Despite innocence, I feel defensive, guilty for the crime of being a girl. The seat of the office chair is so high, my feet don't touch the ground. Perhaps the seat is cranked high because it's a way to enforce authority and procure obedience. My legs swing any time I speak words I've rehearsed in front of the mirror. When I have purged all details about the predator, the principal says, "Thank you for staying quiet." I don't remember offering my silence.
It is assumed. I return to class. He smiles in a way reserved for me. I hate him. I stay until the bell rings. I leave and return when I'm supposed to, a pendulum on her designated course. My school does nothing. At night, I run until my mind detaches from my body. It's the only thing that feels good. I am 23. I am fortunate that my rape is quick and relatively painless. He is economical with time, force, and me. I am 24. A Saturday afternoon, I'm on my shift. He corners me, cups my face in his clammy mitt, and says, "You're so pretty, I could eat you up." I negotiate an apology, but that is all. I am a stain. He is status, wealth, and fame personified. I am 27. We don't need to belabor the details. You are there, my love. I am 28. Again, you have been here with me. Things felt wonderful until they weren't. Or perhaps they weren't wonderful. Perhaps I'm cognizant of some pieces while ignorant of others. Perhaps I've grown to believe this is simply how things are, and I'm continuing a tale I've inherited as a girl in this world. I am 18, 28, 38, and 8. I see another self on the subway, looking like a wad of gum hastily hidden underneath a desk. Gray, hardened, disposed, commonplace. Her eyes meet mine as we try to maintain our balance. I wonder who, where, when. Was she thrown against a wall, into a corner, on the bed, on the ground, or in an alley as her dignity was stolen, her value denied? Were the insults and intimidation thrown at school, over dinner, online, or at work? I can't say, but I recognize the result, as familiar as Mama's perfume. A look that comes from indignity inflicted in any form. It is eyes sapped of light, a spirit withered, a voice silenced. I am 18, 20, 24, 25, 27, 28, the times I have said yes when part of me screamed no. Something is amiss. I don't feel lost, broken, brokenhearted, or disheartened. I know this is my journey to walk, but what haven't I connected? What dragon have I yet to slay? Me. I am 29. I married a bully. I was raised by a bully. And left unchecked, I will become my biggest bully. I absorb the venom around me. I find ways to help the poison course my veins. Here I am, living a story of punishment and longing to find instead a book that is a clear line of unhurried love. My love, I think I've sorted our origins. Within me live two voices, spliced since a toddler. One is calm, loving, and kind, and the other exceptionally destructive. This latter voice declares I'm inadequate, insignificant, insufficient, inept, fat, ugly. It says, listen to him, follow him. It says, you worthless thing, what could you possibly sell but your physical wares? The first voice is you, my imaginary best friend from childhood whom I've never released. And this second voice is my inner lonely child. It answers to many names, one being anorexia. For if control is my father and beauty my mother, anorexia is their offspring. You and the wounded child exist by connection. There is a saying I've carried now for years. Beware the unloved. They will eventually hurt themselves or me. I won't be spliced any longer. I need to align.
Thank you.
that Rima might have one more short excerpt for you to read, and so I want to give the entire stage to Rima, however she wants to inhabit it.
After I left New York, because I had this clear need to realign and reclaim and recover the pieces of me that had been lost or forsaken or abandoned, I bought a one-way ticket to my mother and dad's house here in Portland. We arrive at our resplendent Mecca, Beaverton, Oregon. The suburbs. Difficult not to be bowled over by the spectacular sexiness. Try, if you can, my love, to maintain your composure. I search for Mama's face in the crowd of families waiting for loved ones to disembark. There she is. I have returned to my heart. The moment we five are reunited, we breathe deeper, grin foolishly, and refuse to seize. My brother and I are seized with fatigue. Whenever we return from New York, the second the wheels land on the tarmac in Oregon, this happens. Dad says it's because we finally release the alertness one grips when away from home. You look like a gaunt, lost bird, my brother says to me. He ruffles my hair, squeezes my face with a hand that spans its entire length and width. Little bird, that's his name for me. As always, he is immaculate in presentation. He sports a thin layer of stubble, his version of disheveled and exhausted. Mine is Benjamin Button in his earlier years, a withered old man baby. Now in their home, I watch Mama and Dad. I am in love with their love. This second coming, this second homecoming, this second parent. They layer conversation, taking turns listening, speaking. They seamlessly intuit and anticipate the other's needs and meet them. They fill ordinary moments with memorable sweetness. Every day I watch them greedily, collecting moments like a war-torn nation stockpiles food. I try to be stealthy, but my spontaneous joy gives me away, and I cry. Mama's fear and insecurity that once hung like a heavy shroud has lifted. This mama is vibrant and sassy. She grows more present daily, as though a giant, invisible hand is coloring her in. An indelible imprint occurs when a child is raised, witnessing their mother in perpetual fear. Sensing that she is holding her breath, we learn to do the same. Now, watching Mama eat, laugh, love, and be loved, I begin to feel I am deserving and capable of the same. After two blissful weeks of being together, my brother returns to New York, my sister leaves to visit Papa in Bangkok, and Mama and Dad embark on a one-month road trip. I remain with the family's two dogs, one cat, two bearded dragons, four lovebirds, and an assortment of fish. The evidence of life when we're able to stand still. I'm with a zoo, but also alone. It finds me. My anger, my mangy, lumbering, frothing rage against the world, against characters, against my own choices. Together we haunt this house. My fury lumbers behind me like an enormous, devoted, shaggy pet. I tug it by its dirty, frayed rope, one end tied around its neck, the other around my wrist. You can see the rope rubbing raw the flesh, but neither one of us can undo the knots. Howling with sorrow pent from years, stacked, it feeds on what I supply. At night, we sleep, curled on the same bed, my head on anger's warm belly, my two breaths for its one. You sit by the window, guarding until fatigue pulls you into. Grief has five stages. Shock and denial is the first.
I've already experienced that stage my own way. For long years, I was unaware of how heavy the toll of life had become. Anger is the second stage. This month of silent solitude acts as my decompression chamber. Walking the dogs, changing the litter box, watering the garden, feeding lettuce to the dragons, the routine of humble chores is purifying, soothing, lovely. But memories that hid with the finesse of a fox eluding a hound now emerge. They horrify, they unmake. Mama and Dad return home to find me wild-eyed. I look like the cryptkeeper's wife who has escaped from her cage and is wondering now where to go, only to find that there is nowhere. There is only here. That's the thing about the past. Wherever you go, it exists still, on some plane. Anger then morphs into depression. Depression is usually followed by bargaining. I pass that stage and step into the final, acceptance. I weep, great, huge sobs, a sudden monsoon on an otherwise tranquil summer day. Mama and I sit in her garden. "What is it, John?" my soul in Bengali. She asks, she holds my hand. You didn't fail. You know, this is simply your life, continuing. You'll find something. Or is it him? Do you miss him? Or is it your papa? No, Mama, I'm grieving my life. I sob, naming one after another, the torrent of men who have entered and left my story. I list the trials I've kept from Mama. I recite the 24 addresses I've lived in from childhood on, forever moving. And Mama, the effort and emotion are making me dizzy. I've missed you for a long time. Oh, Rimani, she sighs a sigh pulled from the earth. You're here now. She rubs her eyes. There is so much, John. I need to write. What? No. Her pace quickens. You need help. You can't cry like this. You need a clinic or therapy. But you also need to do something. A job, a plan, a master's program, maybe. You need to think about your future. I am, Mama. I'm conscious of all those things. I know it sounds strange, but you need stability. We're happy as long as you're happy, but you also need to be safe. Mama, safe doesn't make sense to me. She smiles, hands me a tissue. I know, but you need something solid. Yes, I want that too. So all I need to do is write. I have to write this one specific book. You know how I always say I have a voice inside me? Well, yes, John, and we always play along, but seriously, that's crazy. She trails off. Mama, this voice, this book, I can hear it. It'll work. It'll be for me and anyone else who needs. I taper off. It sounds so far-fetched and so far-reaching. What? Love. It'll be love in a book. I can hear it. Mama looks at me, worry knotting her forehead. And your future? Everything will come from the pages. Oh, Rima, that's... She shakes her head. That's crazy. That's such a gamble. No, Mama. Everything else has been. Word spreads through the family. Rima isn't getting a job, she hasn't a plan, and is instead zealously playing out her past in the pages of a book. Most believe this is my thinly veiled emotional breakdown. I certainly look the part. Who are you to write a book? Asks my sister. You'd be a great administrative assistant, says my brother. Dear one, their words hold veracity. For their concern is from love, and their doubts are sensible. I was raised,
fed, bathed, given an education, sent out into the world, and at age 30, I've moved in with my parents. We are a sitcom. Furthermore, as you know, I've never taken a writing class. I am an actress. I got as far as IB English in high school. Those periods were spent worrying about my parents, flirting with boys, and staving off sleepiness from my pesky habit of starving myself. I've yet to publish a single essay, much less a memoir. I don't have a life of fame, glory, or inspiring achievements to write about. I am, despite all efforts to be otherwise, completely mortal. I am entirely ordinary and untrained. Am I enough to fit a book? Another concern plaguing my family is that my writing so openly of my life and our family will destroy us. My love, how can I explain to them that our book may prove not to be our apocalypse, but our rebirth? One page, then another, to prove and pave the path I can only write. Neither fear nor questions can be removed. They can only be walked through and through. I have a few things, but they are sizable. I have you, I have myself, and I have my fierce, resolute conviction fueling our hopeful tale. I have realized you, myself, and the mysterious book live in a trinity. The words that will fill it are the words you and I have shared for decades. Its pages will be our love physicalized. It is how we will vanquish the outer and inner shadows. It is where we will lay to rest our heart. It will be a love letter written to what it is we have been and have been through. We tend to think deaths and events are all that require grieving, but selves, choices, habits, and relationships we've known, they need loving rituals of healing as well. The speed at which life demands we run simply to make it to the next day makes it difficult to see them through. Wounds tally, addictions anesthetize the pain. We try to stitch while moving, but life's racing pace continually tears open old scars and mangles the new ones. Mending while enduring is well meant, but ultimately futile. The sutures never tight enough to hold. By writing, I will revisit and reclaim myself. Year by year, I will peer into the stitching. I will recover what was once lost, forsaken, abandoned, stolen. I am 3, I am 5, I am 11, 13, 18, 23, 27, 28. Darling friend, my imaginary best friend from childhood whom I never released, if you are my madness, then I am happily crazed. There is a fine line between insanity and creativity. The truth about art and imaginary best friends is they fill us with fortitude, faith, and comfort so powerful that to observing eyes, they hint at insanity. But for the artist and the friend, the words, images, and bond feel like the most rational, constant, solid forces. In a world that continually attempts to make us feel powerless and unsafe, you are the one earth beneath my feet. You, my art, my potential, my conviction, my voice are all as real as I allow. We may just work. I look at the reams of pages I've gathered, notes I've collected for these past few years. I look at my stack of journals, a lifetime high. I don't refer to any of the materials. 8 days after I turn 30, I open a fresh white document on my laptop. I title it, I Am Yours.
Who are you to write a book? I am a person, I reply. I am 30. I begin.
That was author Rima Zaman sharing stories from her new memoir, I Am Yours, at Powell's Books. She was joined in conversation with Lydia Yuknovich, author of the New York Times bestseller, Book of Joan. Zaman's memoir has become a Powell's bestseller, and her work has been featured in publications such as The Guardian, Salon, and the New York Times, to name a few. Rima is an Oregon Literary Arts Writer of Color Fellow. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Emily Gresham Beamer with KBOO News.
This is KBOO Portland.
KBOO Radio is proud to co-sponsor the 29th annual Cascade Festival of African Films, happening Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, now through Saturday, March 2nd. Most films will show at the Moriarty Arts and Humanities Building, room 104 at PCC Cascade Campus, 705 North Killingsworth Street in Portland. Again, that's the 29th annual Cascade Festival of African Films, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, now through Saturday, March 2nd. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of a live performance by Antonio Rey on Thursday, March 7th from 7:30 to 9:30 p.m. at the Old Church Concert Hall in Portland. Antonio Rey is one of the leading flamenco guitarists of Spain today. Rey will be with flamenco dancer and singer Mara Rey. Again, that's Antonio Rey on Thursday, March 7th from 7:30 to 9:30 p.m. at the Old Church Concert Hall, 1422 Southwest 11th in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right.